This is the 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine.
Hello, welcome to the 10th Voice. This is Elizabeth Anderson. I'm your host today for the Santa Moran Radio Book Club, and I'm going to be joined by our panelists today. One is here in the studio with me, Jonda Boyce. Hi, Jonda. And I believe we have our others joining us. Let's check. Marianne K. Martin, are you there? Okay, well, while we're getting Carol on the line, let me ask Jonda our first question, which is what reading this book meant to you.
Okay, the book is The Liberators of Willow Run by Marianne K. Martin, one of the panelists today. Hi, Marianne. And
Hi.
For me, it was very personal. I ended up on the panel today because the story resonated so much with me and my family's story. So I would have enjoyed it anyway. It's a great read, but it also, as we'll talk about later, had many parallels to my own grandmother in World War II.
And Marianne, let me ask you, not why reading this book was important, but why writing this book was important?
Oh, for so many reasons, but I guess break it down succinctly, it would be that I needed to write it out of vigilance and to write it out of needing to know where we came from so that we don't dare go back.
And Carol, do we have you on the line?
You sure do.
Wonderful. Thank you for joining us from New York City. What did it mean to you to read this book? Could you tell just a few words?
Wow. It was, well, I think I caught the tail end of what Marianne just said. And, you know, I think it is shows us where we were many years ago, and it reminds us that we don't want to go back there. Although it is also, for me, a kind of a portrait of our country when people were being urged to pull together. And that's one of the things that I think of most of when I think of World War II. But it's also, and again, Marianne reminded me of this in the book, that this was a time when our country was segregated. So it's kind of ironic that we were being told to pull together, but only in certain ways. That we couldn't really all pull together the way we should all pull together.
I think that's an excellent point. And a corollary to that is that women were encouraged to go into the workforce, but they weren't really welcomed once they went in, and certainly after the war was over. Marianne, I wanted to ask you, why did you set it at Willow Run?
Well, Willow Run is sort of in my history, too. I went to school in Ypsilanti, which is just a mile or so away. And it was a huge part of the history of this part of the country here in Michigan. And it was the largest factory in the United States. You know, they called it the Grand Canyon because it was so gigantic. It was like a city in itself. And just, you know, I used to go there to, I mean, that's where you could get your paperbacks, is at the airport there. These sawdry paperbacks that you couldn't get in the regular stores and stuff. It was so funny. So anyway, I was very familiar with the plant and the area and the airport there. Just a couple of years ago, they started wanting to make a museum out of it to save part of the building. And they were successful in getting some monies together and everything. So it was a big push right here in this area. Plus the fact that I have had an elderly neighbor who, in her younger days, actually worked there. So there was a lot of interest in you know, exploring that and really delving into what actually happened personally during that time.
And let me ask you about the research that you did. There must have been considerable. Did you watch documentaries? Did you read nonfiction? What exactly did this involve?
All of the above, plus I found a treasure trove of interviews, video interviews of women who are now, you know, in their 90s, many of them, talking about their experience there. Gosh, there must have been over a dozen that I watched and listened to, and their stories were just fascinating. Being able to put a personal face and voice and their own little personal experiences that I never would have learned from just reading a nonfiction book about the area and about the plants and, you know, all of the physical things that went into it. But all those personal, emotional things that I learned from those interviews were just priceless.
I wanted to ask Carol, what was your family's history having to do with World War II? Do you have personal stories from your mother or any other relatives?
Well, my dad served in the Army, and my parents pretty much got engaged before he went overseas. And I later found, after my uncle died, he was in the Navy, copies of letters that had gone, that he got from people in the family during the war. And it was always interesting to me that they would often start the letter by saying, "We received your letter of," and then they would give the date, and I would think, well, that's sort of a weird thing. And then I realized the mail was the way that people communicated, and whether or not you got a letter from someone and when you got that letter was very important. You know, that if there was a period of time where you didn't have letters, everybody would be very concerned. So that's really the context that my personal connection to World War II.
Let's talk a little about the characters in the book. And letters do play a role for the characters. Certainly, you know, the parents writing to Ruth and to Audrey. Which character particularly hit home for you, Jonda?
I enjoyed reading about Audrey and her work in the plant and the people she befriended. She befriended Nona, a black woman worker in the plant, and confides to Nona that she loves women. Very interesting plot turn. Nona accepts that and draws parallels to suffragettes and also to her own struggle as a black woman. Also, I enjoyed at the end where Audrey is talking about having to conform after working in a plant. She was building bombers and doing hard work. She had to conform to wearing a flowered dress and wearing makeup and how uncomfortable she felt with the things that she had to do to become presentable again after the war, and also dealing with men groping her in the workplace, her supervisors and such. So I enjoyed and felt bad for Audrey's situation changing so rapidly, but she also gets to fall in love. Thanks, Marianne.
And I would have to say Audrey was certainly one of my favorite characters. My mother's name is Audrey. She turned 91 this week, and she was in college during World War II here in Kansas City. And one of the things that I admired about Audrey was she really wanted to go to bat for Nona when Nona was late for work. But she was smart enough to realize that probably wasn't going to be successful. And she was a complex character. Marianne, why did you decide to have Audrey as your main, as one of the main characters?
I thought she embodied so many different aspects of the fight that women were fighting, and lesbians. The workforce and everything that was happening during the war years really acted as a shield for lesbians who wanted that as part of their main normal daily lives, to go to work, to be independent, to have their own money, to make their own decisions, and to be independent of men. And she was able to do that, take advantage of that shield, but there were so many other things in her life that, John just said, being forced to go back into, if she wanted to work, into a workforce that was acceptable to her, to society, but not to her. And her having to internally fight that fight in a way that was safe for her. I felt that she embodied that because she was able to go into a bomber plant and build planes that won the war, and then to have that respect and that honor and that internal achievement to be questioned and downplayed and everything else so immediately after that. It's really difficult for her, but I thought it really embodied a whole group of women who were faced with this during that time.
And Carol, what about you?
I think actually all of the three main characters really resonated for me, although I was very impressed with Nona, who kind of used this as an opportunity to advance her own dreams, which were to become an educator. And she was very focused, and she saved her money, and she wanted to go to college, and she wasn't going to, she was determined to do this, and she wasn't going to allow anything to set her back. The other thing I just want to say about the characters, and I find this true, Marianne, with all the books that I've read of yours, but I think of all of the main characters as having a kind of a strong moral compass, that they know what to them is right, and then they want to act on that. And I think that that is what gives them depth, and it gives them life in a way that it makes you feel like you really could see them on the street one day. And I realized in reading the dedication that this came from your mom, because you said she stood strong for what she believed in and taught that to you.
Thank you, Cheryl, for saying that. I just need to insert something there too, that the nurse character Lillian was based on my mom, who worked in the Crittenden home early in her nursing career, and those were her girls, and she brought them home to us and shared them with us, shared our family with them, and that spoke to me really early when I was very young about what was right and what was worthy to stand up for.
Carol, you mentioned the three main characters and the moral compass, and I agree. Ruth also has a moral compass, because there she is in the home and she's been dropped off by her parents. They're not happy with her. She's going to deliver a baby that she knows is going to be adopted. And she meets Susan, another woman. Marianne, I believe they're in their mid-20s, about 24, is that correct?
Right, yeah.
They could have walked away from the young girl, Amelia, who was 13 and she had been molested, could have gone on with their own problems and their own lives, and so could Lillian. But instead, they saw a vulnerable girl, and Ruth, one of the main characters, stepped in, and Susan left during the novel, and Ruth hung in there. I admired that so much. I thought you wrote that beautifully.
Oh, thank you.
We try not to spoil the plot twists or endings in this show, so I will just add that I enjoy how Ruth and Audrey and Nona all rose to help Amelia, and how it brought them together and showed them what they could do. And I think the book shows us how it helped them figure out maybe more of a mission that would be fulfilling other than jewelry counters and waiting tables after the war is helping other women. I thought that was brilliant to talk about a society of women working together to rescue or step in the hour of need for women who were abused, and finding that fulfilling as well, which I think feminists have done throughout the decades and centuries, have found ways to use that for their own sense of self-worth as well as helping others.
And another thing about Ruth that I appreciated is I think a lot of women would have crumbled when they were abandoned by their family. Her mother crosses boundaries during the book. John is right, we'll try not to give spoilers, but she completely crosses boundaries. And Ruth says, that's not going to happen. That's not okay. And I admired her so much for that as well. Let's talk some more about Nona. She had come north for opportunity, and Carol, you mentioned that she had plans, and she set out to pursue them. One of the things I admired so much about, she had great privation early on. She's in a church basement. There's no privacy. They gave her a place to stay, but she had a long commute to her work in the bomber factory. At one point, she's going to be late for work, and a profiteer takes advantage of her. That was another detail that I appreciated, Marianne. You pointed out that not everybody was noble and pulling together during the war. But what else about Nona? Carol?
Just that she seemed to me to be a very steady person and very practical. But also she was very supportive of Audrey and encouraging her to be honest as her relationship with Ruth is developing, and you know, to be honest with her. I just really admired her a lot. She recognized what was being imposed on her by society at the time, but she worked within it. She decided that she wanted to be friends with Audrey and that the two of them would find ways that they could be together as friends and get to know each other without violating any of the segregation that was in place at the time.
And Marianne, a major theme at GCLS conference, the Golden Crown Literary Society this year, was diversity. And as I read this book, I thought, this is a wonderful glimpse into the life of someone who has all sorts of limitations, but is set to surmount them. What made you include Nona in the book?
Well, one of the videos that I watched was an older black woman who had, I based Nona on her. She had come up from the South, had a really good, strong, solid, conservative background in the area where she lived, but did not want to follow in the footsteps, basically, of what her family and her surrounding community expected out of her. So she had dreams. And when she saw the opportunity, and actually she spoke of how her father had encouraged her to, if you want these dreams, you can't get them here. The only thing you can do would be to leave and go do this, go work. And so she did. And I just watched her as she spoke, and the hold of her shoulders and the hold of her head, just the way she was so confident in her own dream and that she had fulfilled that dream. She had gone to school, she had worked, saved her money, found the man who fit into her life because he wanted the same kind of thing. He was also an educator, that they went on and had their life together, striving to help others and educate them and bring them into their dreams. It was just fascinating to watch her. I went back to that video over and over, and I thought, yes, Nona has to exist.
There's a scene in the book where I mentioned that Nona is late for work. Not her fault. Nothing that she did. She is panicked because she sees this life-giving job possibly going away. And I admired so much, Marianne, the way you had the male character, Jack, who's on the line with the women. He points out that if one of the women step forward to intercede for their co-worker, it will not be taken well. And I thought that was wonderful, the way this decent man steps forward as an ally. He says he does his best Leo the Lip, but he fights for her job, and he's successful. I thought that rang truer than if one of the women had stepped forward. Jonda?
I thought it also rang true that it wasn't necessarily because he was anti-racist, as we would call it today. He says, she's the best. Mm-hmm. Do you want to build bombers? Then you need Nona. And that rang true as well.
Absolutely. And that was part of his character, was that he was so pragmatic, and so this was his mission too. And if we're going to fulfill this mission, we pull the best together and we do it together. And that to him didn't matter, and that would have been fine with him. Anyone, well, you notice too that there was one of the characters had dreams too to become a pilot, and he stuttered, and there was no way he was going to be able to fulfill his dreams. And so, you know, he's on Jack's crew because he's good, and that was him. That was the base of his character, was that you pull the best together, and it didn't matter to him who you were as long as you were a good person and could do the job. And so I wanted to show him, you know, in those lights as well. You're always going to have people in the background that they don't make the big headlines and stuff. They aren't the heroes, but they really are the heroes.
I think that's very true. Carol?
Yeah, I think that's true, too. I thought that was a very good scene. And I also I love the scene where the manager in the restaurant stands up for Ruth, you know, when a male customer objects to her serving a woman first before he served. I thought that was a very good scene.
I agree. For me, that as a reader, that was a pivotal scene. I'm so glad you brought it up, because the customer really was nasty. Both of my sons are in retail, and sometimes they come home and say, you won't believe what this one customer said. Marianne, if you don't mind, I'll just quote. He says, you know, where I come from, you serve a man first, and nice women don't wear trousers and work in factories. And then later on, he refers to Audrey as a woman factory rat in trousers. The manager does step up. He defends Ruth, and he points out that without women in the factories, these bombers aren't going to get made. I thought this was a turning point, because both Ruth standing up and the manager standing up, it caught Audrey's attention. Marianne?
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, there were over 10,000 women working in that plant over the war years. And there were so many connections, so many family connections. And that bomber restaurant is still there, by the way.
That's a real place.
It is a real, yes, it is a real restaurant. It was there. They basically served, you know, morning, noon, and night. They made sure those workers had a place to eat. And, I mean, they could, you know, they also ate at the canteen. And there was an actual, you know, Army station and everything right there on the plant's grounds, and they could eat there, and they could other places, but this was special. And you basically get off campus, you know, for a break, and you go eat someplace that gives a care about what kind of food you have and, you know, gives you something special. And they have been there all these years. And like I said, when I was in college, you know, that was a popular place to go. And they still had all the pictures on the walls and everything. And, you know, for them to be so connected and then to have people that come in that don't get it, that have their own agenda and their own attitudes and aren't bright enough to catch the connection, and then they say something like that or treat somebody like that. I saw that as a really normal response for a manager to say, look around you, basically, get a clue. It didn't seem out of the realm of possibility that that person would be a stand-up guy.
I think you're absolutely right, and it's interesting to me because you had a different kind of manager who I think possibly, I know this is hypothetical, would have acted a very different way, and that's Mrs. Stranton, because I don't think, based on the way you presented her in the book, she would have stood up for her girls. What do you think, Marianne?
No, absolutely not. Part of what I learned from my mother and from a lot of research after this into the changes that went on during the Crittenden home's years of existence, they were extreme. That was extreme, but that's exactly how many of them were run. There was a shaming going on, a desperate shaming of if these women were at fault. And they taught that. I mean, they taught them to be ashamed, and their mission was to make them better people before they left there. You know, just to realizing that, you know, you had young girls coming in there for all kinds of reasons. You can't blame them for everything that happened. And realize, too, that there were no abortions, no legal abortions, very little of any kind of birth control. There just wasn't the protection that women had. And so, you know, then to go into a situation where you're shamed by society, you're shamed by your parents, your family, you are put into a situation where you're going to withstand the blame and the shame for the extent of your pregnancy until you give away this child. It was that intolerable of a situation. And then as the years went on, there were different societal attitudes that changed some of it. It became more, my mother saw the change happening where there was more allowed, there was more education allowed. They were encouraging them to keep their babies. There was a different attitude that was starting to make a difference. But there was still the whole attitude of sending these women away with all kinds of excuses. You know, they went away to take care of an ill grandmother or, you know, blah, blah, blah. But any excuse to hide the truth.
I remember when I was in high school in the 60s, a couple of my classmates went off to visit relatives. It was just the way things were handled in Western Massachusetts in the mid-60s. It was not done to stay at home and have the baby. It was a fairly Catholic community.
Send in 1,000 grandmothers, they will surely volunteer. With their aged wisdom flowing, they will lend a loving ear. They will lend.
This is the Sandra Moran Radio Book Club, and we are discussing The Liberators of Willow Run with the author, Marianne K. Martin, another author, Carol Rosenfeld, and my friend, Jonda Boyce.
Great. I have a question for you. This is Jonda. I wonder, in your research on women in World War II, if you turned up much about lesbians or gay men in World War II and the liberties that they got to take in all-female or all-male environments, like the women who all worked in the plant together, or, you know, other environments that brought people together to recognize their own kind.
I didn't get a lot, I think, more focused on the environments were integrated as far as the plants and things like that went, on the jobs that were available to women like Ruth. But, you know, I did catch a little bit of it. Part of it was interesting, a couple of interesting reads that talked about the fact that this, in effect, was a shield. This was a shielded period of years where they were allowed to do things and feel things and accomplish things that normally they would be standing out like a sore thumb. And, you know, especially lesbians, they were, you know, allowed to dress in pants. They were allowed to go out together in groups, without men. They ate in restaurants by themselves. Things that normally, I mean, we think of it now as just everyday life. Of course we can do these things, and we don't necessarily wear a neon sign across us that says I'm a lesbian, but we don't stand out as much either, because there's so many women now, independent women, working in the workforces, and it's not a big deal. But back then, it just wasn't acceptable. There were only certain acceptable positions and jobs, and to go beyond that, you really stuck out and probably wouldn't be allowed to do it. So this was a really protected period of years where they got to feel part of the norm without standing out so much. And then, of course, afterwards, to try to fit back in again, or, you know, they had a choice, fit back in again or boldly go where they've not gone before, you know. And some of them really put themselves out there, and the 50s was really, it was tainted as this kind of horrible period of adjustment for, especially for lesbians, because you had that choice. Where do you go from here? Do you go back, or do you find a way to forge ahead and continue the achievements and the kind of life that you want to live? Do you fight for it and be beaten, or all the things that have happened in the past and still do happen, but just not as great a percentage?
I think that's an important point you just made. And Carol, you and I are about the same age. Did you grow? You grew up on the East Coast, is that correct?
Yes.
And do you find when you were, say, in your teens? I know I didn't see any representation of lesbians or gays on television or in any movies that I saw. What was your experience? Was it a very different time?
I was in the suburbs, so I suppose that matters. I mean, I certainly didn't see anything in my high school, but oddly enough, I did have people in my family, not lesbians, but two gay men. One cousin of mine, I mean, I knew, I didn't really know the word, but he was very, what would be today, I guess, described as effeminate or some other word. And so I knew that he was that, but nobody really talked about it. They just would say, well, Sheldon's very sensitive, you know, because he would cry a lot, and he smoked, and his smoking was like very elaborate. It was like something out of a Hollywood movie. And then I had another cousin who was a choreographer. People would say, well, Ron is in the theater. And those were the euphemisms that they kind of used. So I sort of knew, but I didn't really, I guess, get all of it. But I got some of it.
I have young friends who were in their 20s and 30s, and they can't even comprehend that there was a time when, say, two women couldn't kiss freely. And I thought the depiction of Audrey and Ruth's relationship in the early stages was really deftly done, because they had to be careful. They had to be very careful. Where they met, ice cream was safe. And Marianne, I have to compliment you on that.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that you can do all the reading. And like I said, you can listen to the videos and everything, but it comes down to understanding the period of time on a personal level, not just the fact that this was illegal or that was illegal or what was acceptable and wasn't, but on a personal level, she was able to or boldly went to the bus by herself at night. Those are things that just were not done. Those are the nuances that help make it real and help make, like you were saying, the younger people understand what it felt like, not just what it was, but what it would feel like if they themselves were put in that position. And sadly, we are in a very scary time right now when a lot of these, you know, things that were accepted and part of these young women's rights when they were born, they grew up with an understanding that this was okay and this was acceptable and there was never a time when it wasn't. It's important for me as a writer to make it real to these people, that especially young women, young men too, because I think we need to include them, because there are jacks in the world right now. There are people that are totally accepting, and especially young men who understand that this is just silly to even think about problems with, you know, women's rights. Of course women should have their rights, of course. You know, this is what they think and feel. And until they are a bigger majority of our country, we are still fighting that battle. And I think all of a sudden, a lot of young women right now who are marching and resisting are saying, oh my God, I never, ever thought this would happen. And I think it's important to show them that, yes, it did once happen. You do not want to go back there.
And actually, you've anticipated my next question, which is, are there parallels between your novel and what is happening in the country today? Jonda?
I couldn't say it better than she did, honestly. You know, I think it's important to know our history and to work really hard to make sure that we try to keep as much forward motion as we can right now.
Carol?
Oh, definitely. And I think I'm thinking in particular about the Crittenden home and the judgment and the shaming, and how there are people in the government who really do feel that they have this proprietary interest in a woman's body and what she can do with it.
Mm-hmm. And I have a question particularly for Jonda and Carol, and that is, do you picture this book being a film? The Price of Salt was set in the 50s. It became a film, Carol. And this is a book about World War II and women. What do you think, Carol?
Yeah, I could definitely see it as a film. I think the characters are strong, and actually the dialogue is very strong, and it's got some, again, we're not going to spoil anything, but some very exciting plot points in it. So, yeah, I definitely could see it as a film.
And the setting, oh my gosh, I would love to see Willow Run, just see the scene set in that factory. Jonda?
Definitely. I watched all the episodes of Bomb Girls, which is set in Canada during World War II, but they're making munitions for the war. And I could definitely see Liberators of Willow Run as a film.
And while I was reading the book, I was watching Foyle's War. And there's one episode that is set with women, and they're building warheads in a factory, and the parallel between the two was just fascinating to me. Let me go ahead and let you answer this question too, Marianne. Could you see your book being a film?
Well, it would be an honor to have it made into a film for more than one reason, not just a personal reason, but because it would hopefully reach a lot more people and a lot more young women who really need to feel. I guess that's what I hope that I do with my writing is put them in that place and let them feel what these people felt, and, you know, give them all of the realism of the time. And I think, Carol, that movie, I was so impressed with that movie because it did. It showed you the slowness, the letters having to respond by letter and how long it took, and just things like that it made you feel that. And the fact that young women that watched that show were so upset with how slow everything developed, but they were feeling that's the frustration. That's exactly what you would feel. And of course, now knowing how quickly everything is communicated and how quickly things can get done, you can see the contrast. But if they have to have something to contrast it with, if all they know is the speed of communication and the speed of relationships, how quickly people get in and out of relationships and how open everything is, if that's all you know and you don't have a contrast, then you can't understand where you've been, how far you've come as a woman and as a lesbian. If for no other reason that it would reach a lot of young women, I would love for that to happen.
It's very interesting to me that you said that, because in one lesbian reading group, there were some younger people complaining about the pacing of the film. Oh my God, could they take longer to light cigarettes? And, you know, just complaining. And guess who stepped in and said, no, this is the way it really is, and had a wonderful exegesis of this time? Catherine V. Forrest commented.
Yeah.
And I thought she did a wonderful job. You saw that, Marianne?
No, but I can hear her saying it. I can hear her.
She did a terrific job. And of course, then the comments were, oh, we didn't know. And I think that's what your book does. Certainly, your book inspired me to do some research. I remember my mother telling a story about here in Kansas City. And if you don't mind, I'll just mention, she was at Park College, a Presbyterian college here in Kansas City, which had a history from the 1800s of being inclusive. My grandparents graduated from there. My grandmother put her way through college. They graduated in the early 20th century. There were 7 Japanese students who were brought from the West Coast. And, of course, during World War II, over 100,000 Japanese were placed in internment camps. And the president of Park College worked to bring 7 college-age Japanese students to campus. Well, what happened, it was called the Battle of Parkville. a group of Platte County, Missouri citizens tried to ban them and said they can't come. And the board met, the board of trustees, for 2.5 hours and decided to let the Nisei stay in school because their loyalty is unquestioned. Well, what happened is the students welcomed the evacuees. All six of the undergraduate social clubs rushed them and invited them to join, but Parkville residents stormed the hill and tried to come after them. And the college students put the seven students on the top floor of a dormitory, blocked the stairways so that the residents couldn't come up and get them. And when store owners refused to serve them, Park students went with the Japanese students and said, if you don't serve them, we'll boycott you. And it was very effective. The students did graduate. I thought that was an interesting story from World War II. My mother remembers that.
Absolutely. That's wonderful.
And I want to invite John to here to tell the story of her grandmother, because your book inspired her to go back and look at this again.
And that's how I ended up on the panel. I told Elizabeth the story of my grandmother, Pearl, and she lived on a farm in northern Missouri on the Iowa border with seven kids, and at 18 or 19 came to Kansas City, Missouri, where I now live, to work in a bomber plant. This bomber plant in Kansas City built B-25s. In the book, they were building B-24 Liberators, and it was an enormous workforce. It had 23,500 workers at its peak here in Kansas City, Kansas, I will add, not Kansas City, Missouri. So I don't know if my grandmother lived in Kansas or Missouri, irrelevant. But she doesn't just have parallels with Audrey, the factory worker. And as an aside, she says she worked in bookkeeping. She doesn't tell stories of working on the factory floor, but she worked in a 23,500 employee plant building bombers by keeping books. She also has parallels with Ruth, and that's the story that I told Elizabeth, where she said, please, if your family doesn't mind, come and talk. My grandmother had a baby at a home for unwed mothers in 1944 in Kansas City. It was a Catholic one in this case, and so there wasn't this debate that the women have in Marianne's book about to keep the baby or not. They were not keeping the baby. The nuns had plans for the babies. And we did not know this until 10 years after she died. She never told her five children, one of whom is my father. She never told any of us, but my aunt found a letter 10 years after my grandmother had died that outlined what had happened and that she was trying to find him. And we did. He lives in rural Kansas, and most of us have met him, and he was on record as wanting to know birth family, so it wasn't difficult to convince him to meet with family. And, of course, looks like it was just the most incredible, chilling thing to think of her living her whole life with that secret and wanting to find him and not finding him, and feeling that the nun stole her baby is the tenor of the letter as well.
And, Marianne, I have to congratulate you, because that atmosphere, the setting that you created, rang so true that it just felt like a book we had to discuss. Carol, any thoughts here?
I'll just add that I'm adopted, and so I was very interested in the whole thing with the Crittenden home. Although my birth mother, it was a private adoption, so my adoptive parents paid for her medical expenses. But it also reminded me a little, I don't know how many people have seen the film Philomena, which is with Judi Dench, but about a woman who was in Ireland, and she gave, you know, her baby was actually ended up giving up the baby, and or it being taken away from her, and she tried to find him. So it's really, there's a lot of stories from that time. I mean, nowadays when women can be single mothers can decide that they want to have a child and be a single mother without a partner, it was very, very different back then.
I think it's very important that we not go back to where women can't make their own decisions. Again, I don't want to spoil anything, but Audrey's former lover has horrific experiences. I'll just leave it at that. And I don't think we want to go back to a time when parents make the decisions for grown daughters and when the government can make decisions for women and for girls. Marianne?
Yeah, which the scary, like I said, the scary thing about the time we're about to enter, we will have a vice president who believes in conversion therapy. How far away are we from shock therapy to conversion therapy? You know, just it's the same mindset. to think that someone is in that powerful of a position and that there are others who will agree with him is just frightening.
It is. When I came out in the early 90s, I was 41. I had two young sons, and my father told me, and he meant it. He disowned me for a year, so he absolutely meant it, that if he could put me in an institution and have electroshock therapy, he absolutely would do it. And he said, I'm just sorry, that's not allowed. I'm like, I'm 41. One thing I want to ask, because we're running out of time, is you all are very active in projects that help our community. And I want to start with you, Carol, because you are the chair of the Publishing Triangle Award. So could you talk a little about that?
The biggest thing that the Publishing Triangle does, really, is to give, we give annual awards for fiction, debut fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. And now we have a transgender and Trans and Gender Variant Literature Award, also that we just started that last year, and we work with the Farrell Grumley Foundation to do a fiction award, and we give a Lifetime Achievement Award as well. It's a chance to recognize literature out there, and there's a lot of it. I'm always very encouraged by the number of submissions that we receive for our awards, and it just tells me that there's a lot of people writing, and I think that that's really good.
And Marianne, you aren't just an author, although that is a very prominent position. You are also very active in the Legacies of Lesbian Literature Project, which you started and invited Sandra Morian into. Can you give a little bit of an update on that?
Yes, we're in the phase, just heavy into the phase one, where we raised enough money, raised enough funds to interview our living legends, Lee Lynch and Joel Gomez and Jennifer Levin and Mary Jane Meeker and so many of these wonderful writers who are still with us, and we need to hear from them. We need to get them on film and include them in this project in a very living way, not just talking about them, but hearing their words. So that's what we're doing right now. If the end product will be a documentary documenting the literature, our literature from the 20s to present day, and hopefully making this an interesting, intriguing, educational tool for colleges and universities and libraries and reading groups, anyone else that would be interested in knowing a little about our history and where we came from, and hopefully give a little bit of an idea of where we might be going.
Well, I want to thank so much you, Marianne, for writing this book and for being on the show, and Carol Rosenfeld for joining us from New York City, and Jonda here in the studio. She's going to be in Washington, D.C. at the Women's March next week. So it's wonderful to be with three women who are all working hard to make a difference.
As are you, Elizabeth.
Next month on the book club, we're going to be talking about Richard Blanco's The Prince of Los Cocuyos, Miami Childhood.